to the book of Hebrews, chapter 13 and verse 1. A couple weeks ago, I ended chapter 12, and we just talked about worshiping God with reverence and with awe. One of the observations that I made is that the little word worship in that chapter 12 is actually from the Greek word that is the idea of serving God. So, in the service to God, in our serving God and thus acknowledging and worshiping God by our very actions, we are to go about that with a sense of reverence for God and a sense of awe of what God has done and what God has taught us. But now, when you turn to chapter 13, he begins some specific applications of that. Let brotherly love continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unaware. Remember those who are in prison, as though in prison with them, and those who are mistreated, since you also are in the body. Let marriage be held in honor among all. Let the marriage bed be undefiled, for God will judge the sexually immoral and the adulterous. Keep your life free from the love of money. Be content with what you have. For He has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So we can confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? And as we look at these little admonitions, they simply make a six-verse synopsis of part of how we ought to live. And what it starts with is that we are to love each other. We are to be in love with the church, that is, with the brethren. When we talk about each other, Jesus said in John chapter 13, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you are to love one another. By this people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love one for another. I preached for a little church back in Oklahoma when I first started preaching, back when the dinosaurs roamed the earth. And I moved in this little town, and that was in the early 70s. The little church there was made up of about 16 people back in the 60s. And they started fussing with one another and feuding with one another. And it grew into the fact that they invited two big-name preachers from northern Oklahoma and southern Texas to come and have a debate in this little church of 16 people. And when the debate got done, eight of them got up and went two blocks down. The town was only three blocks wide, so couldn't go any further. Went two blocks down and built another church building and put Church Christ out in the front, and they met down there. And I moved into this little town 10 years later, and they were still talking about it. And every time I'd introduce myself, somebody would say, what went on down there? And I had to smile and say, that was before my time. And I just ignored the issue because I couldn't go back and solve that. But I'm going to tell you, personal work in that town was impossible. I could not convince anybody that they needed to be part of a group that could not live together and love one another and treat each other with dignity and respect. So, Jesus had this absolutely right, which I'm not surprised. By this the world will know you are my disciples if you love one another. And in a society that everything, I don't know whether you've watched TV recently or not, everything is confrontational. Even a cooking show is confrontational. Now, I can understand how you get mad at your stove, but why does everything... And the answer is because that is exciting in our society. And to find a group of brethren that simply love one another completely with a pure heart would be a group that people would want to join. So, we have our work cut out for us. Jesus said again in John 15, verse 12, "This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you." And He said in verse 17, He said, "These things I command you so that you will love one another." Have you all counted that? That's five times in this little section. Love one another, love one another, love one another. So I'm going to ask you, what do you all think Jesus wanted us to do? And He emphasized that. Out of all of the things that He emphasized to the apostles that last night was, we need to learn to love one another. One of our songs, number 219, "How Sweet and Lovely." And I want you to pay attention to the words. We're going to sing it. But I want you to read the words as you're singing that, and I want you to say, this is my prayer to God. This is my commitment to God. This is what I'm going to do. No, so how sweet, how heavenly is this sight. We know that love the Lord in one another's peace delights and so fill the world. How each can be his brother's eye and with him apart. When sorrow flow from high to high and joy from heart to heart. When freedom in me showed and bright, our wishes all above. Each can his brother hailing hide, and show a brother's love. When love in one delightful stream through every bosom blows. When union's weight and dearest aim in every action glows. Love is a golden chain that binds the happy homes above. And he's an heir of heaven you find, his bosom glow with love. When you meet with a group of people that love one another, what happens in your attitude towards God and your attitude towards life and your attitude towards problems makes everything good. But the moment that you meet with some people that don't love one another, you find yourself arising on Sunday morning dreading to go to services. And I can't imagine doing that for any length of time. Because pretty soon you become negative about God. And you become negative about righteousness and holiness. And so Jesus said, love one another. Peter said, love one another with a pure heart, fervently. Paul said in Romans 12, we owe no man anything but this, to love one another. We need to practice this idea of love. But then the second thing that the writer of Hebrews said is, This love is not just to ourselves, but rather He is encouraging us to learn to love those that we don't know. I don't know how broad that goes, but every time I read this passage, I think of the story of the Good Samaritan. When he came across a guy that he'd never met before, probably never going to meet again. And what he did was he acted as a neighbor to this guy that he did not know. He acted in a brotherly love unto this man whom he never met before. That would have resonated the innkeeper that he took him to. He would have seen this act of love. The man that received the attention would have seen the love of God in this man's heart. And so this idea literally is a lover of strangers. In order to be an elder, one of the qualifications was that they were to in fact be given to hospitality. And that's the noun form here. What happens is they are to be given to the loving of strangers. In the first century, in Acts chapter 8, as the church began to grow, the persecution against the church came and the brethren left Jerusalem. Well, where did they go? Somewhere safe. They just left. So they went to the towns and to the villages and to the next big cities. And there, when they arrived, where do you stay? You know, we can go to Priceline.com and we can get a good hotel at the cheapest rate and we can read the reviews of that. But I've read the reviews of what inns were like in the first century. Most of them were brothels. Almost all of them were beer joints. And the rooms were absolutely filthy. They did not have codes that they had to meet and inspections that they could fail. You just did what you wanted to do. And so, if you were traveling in the first century, where did you stay? Many of the preachers, like Paul, as he traveled and he would come into a city like Philippi, where was he going to stay? When Jesus sent the apostles out in the limited commission of Matthew 10, He said, whatever town you come to, if you find those that are worthy, stay with them. Because that's how it worked in the first century. And so, as the persecution would come, and as the preachers would go, what would happen is, they needed to be able to find places to stay. We don't have the exact same problems today. When I travel, I go ahead and make hotel arrangements. We can do this ahead of time. But how do we then begin applying this idea of lover of strangers? And I want to give you what I think is a very practical suggestion to this. When Vernon Kelly was still here and young, Betty Kelly was a good cook. Still is. Makes one of the best apple pies I've ever had. But she would make dinner on Sunday. There was two of them and she would always make enough to feed eight. Because they were going to invite somebody home with them that afternoon. And the first thing they did when they got here was they looked around to see, is there somebody we don't know? And the first thing they would do is they would just latch on to them and say, we want you to come home and eat with us today. And they would go home and they would eat with them and they would be entertained with all the stories that they could tell. And they would have a good meal. And they got to know each other. And when you've gone to a place like that and somebody has just taken you into their home and they have shown you the kindness and they fed you and when you leave that place, you have good remembrances. When we have new people that show up here, and I'm going to tell you, almost every week we have somebody shows up new. Some of them are only here for one time. That's okay. Some of them have just moved into town. We've had about three people that have moved into town in the last couple of months. And what happens is we need to latch on to them. That's just hospitality. That is a lover of strangers. And it is not waiting for them to ask us to lunch, but it is us taking the time simply to get to know them, to have them into our homes, to take them out a cup of coffee or just whatever it takes to simply provide from ourselves for what they have need of. If they're just visiting here, to write down your phone number and say, if you're here and you need something, call me. And I'll help whatever I can do for you. And if we became this kind of a congregation, that everybody that walked through the door was loved by the whole group, and we simply absorbed them and made them part of our group, it's hard telling the impact that would have over the years. That is what the writer of Hebrews said. We are to love one another, and we are to love those that come into our midst. He then added a third point. And he said, what you need to do is you need to remember the prisoners. Now, I've never been much gung-ho on the idea of a prison ministry as such. I know some people have done that, but my experience having done this and talking with people, that is not what the writer of Hebrews was talking about. What happened in the first century was, Saul made havoc of the church, arresting men and women that were Christians and throwing them in prison. In the book of Revelation, they were warned, many of you shall be thrown into prison. Jesus warned the apostles, when you go, they will arrest you and bring you before kings. You begin reading the book of Acts, and the first thing that happens is Peter and James and John get arrested. And then they preach again, and they get arrested again. And they preach, and they get arrested again. And Paul began traveling, and when he came into Philippi, he got arrested. As he traveled to other places, he got arrested. And then they left him in prison in Caesarea for 2 years. And then they sent him to Rome and they left him there for years. So I got looking at that the other day and I thought, I wonder if that's like Pima County Jail. And I found out, not at all. Two things happened. You see it in Paul's life. As he was arrested, he was a Roman citizen. And they didn't have jails, as we talk about, jails, correction facilities. So what they did was, if you were a Roman citizen, they would allow you to live with selected people in town under, like, house arrest. And that was pretty good. But if you weren't a Roman citizen, they didn't care what happened to you. They would chain you up in a dungeon. Somewhere out of sight, out of mind, where you couldn't bother anybody. And they'd just leave you there. There was no guarantee that you had the right to an expeditious hearing. They didn't care. A lot of times what they did was they threw you in jail until you confessed, even though you never did it. After a while, you simply confessed. And while you were there, they didn't serve you 3 meals. They didn't serve you any meals. And while you were there, they didn't have hot water, and they didn't have toilets, and they didn't have clothing for you. You provided whatever you were going to provide. And so, when the Christians were arrested and they were thrown in prison, they were not Roman citizens. They were not put in a fancy house under house arrest. They were taken to deplorable conditions and thrown in and simply the doors locked and you just stayed there. And so people would have to then find you and come and to help. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 25 when He was describing the Day of Judgment, I was sick and you didn't visit me. I was in prison and you didn't visit me. Though you did this to the least of my brethren, you did it unto me. And that gives you the same insight. That we're not talking about just going out here to the prison and visiting all of the felons that deserve to be there. But we're talking about those that were our brothers in the Lord, who were now in desperate straits because they were locked up with no support at all. And these people were said, you remember them. Why? Because you may be next. You need to remember them because you also are in the body. Commentators argue about that. One group says, you're in the body, that is, you're in the same church that they are in, which is the body of Christ. And I go, makes sense. Another group says, no, body there just means body. You're still alive in the flesh and kicking, and it may happen to you. And I go, that makes sense too. I don't know which one is right. They're both right. And so what he said was, we need to have concern for those types of people. And again, in our country, this is not going to happen right now, but it may happen in a few years over some social issues. But I'll tell you what it does mean. When people are having problems, we need to help. Did y'all see how much it meant to the Olson family this morning? And when Chris tried to talk this morning, it came from his heart, made it hard to talk. And when people are having problems and we can rally around them and we can help and we can lift them up, and, you know, we've helped a lot, and there's not a single one of us that has suffered from it. There's none of us that have had to give out of our very living in order to help those that were having problems. We're still giving out of our abundance of what we have. And we give of our time. We give of our money, obviously. And I'm still almost convinced that of those two, your time means more to people. And so we need to take a look, and we need to be a church that is caring for those that are having problems. And we need to visit and we need to encourage them. The Roman period was just as bad morally, or more so, than we are now. I read a report one day and they said they married to divorce and they divorced to marry. And I read about one Roman woman. She could not remember what year it was, except she remembered it by which husband she was married to. And so, oh yeah, that was the year of Harry, and that was the year of Bill, and that was the year of Mark. And we think that Elizabeth Taylor was immoral, but my point on this is, this is what we're in the first century. So, what was the church supposed to do to overcome the immorality in their society? And the way that they overcame that, the Hebrew writer says, is, for you, you put marriage on a pedestal. You make marriage honorable in your life and what you're doing. So, I've made marriage very honorable, I just don't treat Sharon very well. What? You can't do that. If you make marriage honorable, honor your spouse. That's what that means. Honor your commitment. Honor your relationship. Honor your marriage. And when we do that, this is what God says will infect and affect our community. The other is winning, but we can't give up. And when we talk about this marriage, what we're talking about is faithfulness to our spouse. Faithfulness to the commitment that we make. And in the first century, it was easier to get a divorce than it is now. But the early Christians did not do that. The early church would not allow their people to do that and still be part of the group. He simply said, you cannot live that way. We need to emphasize that. So he said, what we need to do is to honor the relationship that we are in. Husbands, love your wives. Even as Christ loved the church and gave Himself for it. Paul told Timothy and Titus, they were to teach the younger women to love their husbands. Parents are to love their children. We honor this relationship by strengthening our relationships. And I'm going to tell you something I've watched over the years, and you can read statistics on this. The best influence of making sure your children stay married is for you to stay married. And the best statistic to show what happens to children in good marriages is you take a look at their parents. And I've watched this. It's not 100%, but I'm going to tell you what. When you see grandma and grandpa divorce, and then you see mom and dad divorce, you know what's going to happen to little Billy. He's not going to know how to honor the relationship and commitment and to stay married. So teach them by doing that. The Hebrew writer then said, and let your life be free from the love of money and be content with what you have. That love of money phrase you all are very familiar with because Paul said the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil on that. And what happens is those that desire to be rich, they're going to bring into their life pain and sorrow and obstacles and problems. And all I've ever said about that is, well, I don't want to be really rich. I just want to be a little richer than I am. But there's the problem. Because what he has said is, we need to learn to serve God in the situation that we're in. The idea of being content to serve God does not mean that you cannot better yourself in your situation. Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, if you are a slave, remain a slave. If you have the opportunity to become free, that's far better. Go ahead and do it. So you can improve your situation in life. But what the emphasis is whether you can or whether you can't, your life is serving God. And so I'm going to serve God until I lose everything. No. Job served God and then he lost everything. And he served God. That's what it takes. And so the idea of this is rather than having a love for material things in our life and the first things in our life, we have a desire first to love our brethren and to be godly in our life. And thus, I'm willing to be content. And y'all remember the other passage on this, Philippians 4. I have learned in whatever state I am therein to be content. And I usually say, but he never had to live in Texas. But he meant in whatever condition of life that he found himself. And so he goes on to say, and this is the verses that never get quoted. I've learned to be in riches and abundance, and I've learned to be in want. And what he did was when he was in abundance, he served God just as strongly as when he was in want. Or let's flip that. When he was in a state of deprivation and want, he served God just as strongly as when he had everything in life on his table. When we make the statement that I'm going to serve God in whatever state that I am, we mean that my service to God is first, and there are no conditions to it. There are no situations that will turn me away. Poverty, or riches, or sickness, or health. We will serve God because He is worthy of that. But along with that, what He said was, we thus, in order to be content, have to learn to trust God. For it says, I will never forsake you. And again, these little verses always end up on those daily little verse thingies. And so you read this and all you get is this one little verse thingy. And we like that. God will never forsake me. And then all of a sudden you have one of those years where everything goes wrong. You lose your house, you lose your job, you lose your car, you lose your friends, you lose your health, and we begin grumbling and complaining and pulling back from that. And where's your trust in God? And as we begin doing this, God hasn't forsaken you. Where was God when James was beheaded? Where was God when Stephen was stoned? Where was God when Jesus was crucified? And I'm going to tell you, He was right where He always was. He was with them every step of the way, every minute of their life. He was there, but He never promised us that we would not have to live contented in poverty. We learn to be content in whatever state we are. And by being content, God will be with us. Even if we die serving Him, God is with us as we die. That's hard to swallow. I would much rather preach it this way. God is going to be with you, and that means you're never going to lose your job, and you're never going to lose your house, and you're never going to get sick, and you're never going to have problems, and your neighbor's dog is not going to... But you can't promise that. Because that happens to the good and the evil. The difference is, you serve God. And you serve God by loving the brethren, by loving strangers. You learn to serve God by remembering your brethren that are in hard times. You serve God by honoring your marriage and being the best godly spouse that there is. You honor and serve God by trusting Him and not seeking after the things of the world. He crammed so much in 6 verses that I'm going to work on this for years. Just trying to put all of this onto my plate and balance the plate. But there it is. And of course you realize, verse 7 just continues. And we're going to talk about other things. But write these down. Go home and read this week. Pick the one that you're not doing very well at. And improve on that one. This is what it means to serve God. To be a disciple of Jesus means He has all authority. And thus, I'm going to follow Him whatever He asks. So He said, go into all the world and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you, and lo, I'm with you forever to the ends of the earth. You can be a servant of God tonight. You start by being baptized, and then you live your life serving God by serving the brethren. And if you're subject to that invitation, we invite you to come as together we stand and sing.